We'll just go ahead and get started, because when you're going to talk about human sexuality, you want to leave a little bit of time at the ends of this. This is a part of a presentation that I did for the Point Loma PALCON last year, but there's some new stuff in it, and then there's some other new stuff that I'm still working on. I have to apologize to you. I actually brought a book that I published under Trevecca Press for you. It's called Human Sexuality, A Primer for Christians. It's written as a theological curriculum for us to use in our churches for it. But I was at the Colorado District Assembly, and they bought them all. So I don't have any with me, and I'm down to about the last box of them anyway. So my apologies, but if any of you really want it, just jot me your name and address, and I can mail you one later. So. Thanks. Have you used it any with groups or anything?
No. I'm
interested to know how it's playing in groups that are out there. I'm working on a second edition of it because a ton of stuff happened since I wrote that one. So there'll be a new one out soon. Okay, well, let me just jump in. I'm going to read a little bit, so forgive me for those of you who've had a big meal and it's middle of the afternoon nap. We'll see how it goes and try to leave some time at the end for questions. So, we're all riding this roller coaster together. Like good Nazarenes, we've invited everybody to come on board. Our conservative safety belts are securely tightened. We've got our quasi-Pentecostal hands up in the air. And here we go, coasting down the track of culture, with its slow climbs, its plummeting drops, its upside-down loops, and its steep curves. And all of a sudden, something happens. We never saw it coming. A wheel comes off our coaster and is no longer capable of holding the track. Now, as long as the track is straight, we can coast. But there's a steep curve ahead, one that has the potential to throw us all. So what do we do? Well, some of us lean right, away from the curve, believing that the conservative approach that has taken us through many a sharp curve will hold us now. Some of us lean left, into the curve, believing that a changing world requires a fresh response from God's people. The dividedness of the leaners and the jostling for the right and the left caused many of our fellow riders to go independent. They lower their hands, loosen their belts, and they bail before we hit the curve in hopes of landing somewhere less divisive. So the right leaners and the left leaners go into the curve believing that they are each right and the other is wrong. Whichever is in the majority will most likely be the proud owner of a wrecked roller coaster. Is this where we are as a denomination in issues of human sexuality? It certainly is where the Episcopalians have been, the Methodists are now, and the Nazarenes are probably headed. Is this a ride that you're excited to be on? I'm not. And I want some better options than leaning right or leaning left. So I'm going to take a stab today at what I think is our best path forward in addressing questions of human sexuality. We've done some work across the years. If you look at our manual, you'll see that lots of statements have shown up in various places. Most of them are in our Covenant of Christian Conduct and the appendix. If you categorize each topic by the number of lines devoted to it, this is what we have. We have 7 lines devoted to a theology of sexuality, 11 to the theology of marriage, 3 to premarital sex, 10 lines that talk about homosexuality, 15 that talk about pornography, 16 that talk about sexual misconduct by a minister, 4 about sexual abuse, and 91 lines that talk about divorce. If you weigh the language, it appears that we're most concerned with divorce, and we reserve our strongest gust of anger for ministerial misconduct, pornography, and homosexuality when you weigh the weight of the words that are in there. It takes us, and of all these lines, and I categorize them, we use 18 lines to say what we are for and 139 lines to say what we are against. And we have said little or absolutely nothing about singleness, human trafficking, sex trade, cross-gendered persons, intersex, and gay marriage. But this is not our most significant problem. Here's my opening belief. for lack of a theology of human sexuality that is biblical, cohesive, and Wesleyan, we find ourselves needing to repair a missing wheel on our roller coaster while hurtling toward a curve that has the potential to derail the church and injure a lot of people. We're in desperate need of a biblical theology of human sexuality. What is actually needed, but impossible at the present moment, is for the coaster to be taken off the track, repaired in the shop, tested by experienced roller coaster theologians, and then put back into service. But as pastors, you don't get that luxury. In your world, a homosexually oriented couple shows up at your church, wants to be married, become members, and sing in the choir. That's where you get to start. You don't have the luxury of saying, we're going to hit the pause button and spend the next year taking a careful look at what the Bible says to us about human sexuality. Then we're going to read together the work of other denominations and their theologians. Then we'll write a curriculum and disciple our youth. We'll establish a better understanding of singleness and marriage. And then we'll get back to you. You don't get to say any of that. Pastors live on a cultural roller coaster, and you never know what is around the next curve. As a pastor, you have daily decisions to make about a heterosexual couple living together unmarried in the church, about the teen of a prominent church family who's now out of the closet, about a dearly beloved choir tenor who requests prayer for his sex change operation that's coming up. So what do you do? I mean, really, what do you do? Do you nail a new 95 thesis to the church door and deal with it at the point of entry? Do you make the dreaded follow-up visit that suggests to a person that another church might be more open to you? Is this a discipleship issue? Do you draw the line at membership? Or do you just launch enough pulpit grenades and hope the shrapnel alleviates the problem? And then what does it mean that our own manual has this sentence in it? We recognize those who violate the conscience of the church and do so at their own peril and to the hurt of the witness of the church. Does this mean they're welcome to stay or that they should go? We don't know which. We have no compelling larger narrative of human sexuality from which to address the brokenness of our world. Our reaction to destructive sexual behaviors does not rise from a commonly owned theology. And just appending biblical text at the end of our assembly-voted opinion does not constitute a cohesive theological narrative. So here we are at PALCON, and we want to have a conversation about human sexuality, so let's do. Let's take the roller coaster off the track for an hour and see how we might repair it and stabilize it for the curves ahead. Let's revisit for just a moment the biblical narrative of human sexuality. A narrative is a way of framing reality or framing meaning. This comes from a teacher named Mike Metzger. And I want you to just read this. I'm not going to read it to you. I want you to read this and you decide, is this comprehensible or is it meaningless? Okay. First time I read that, I thought, what? Now, let me give you one framing word that suddenly lets something make sense, and the word is kite. Now, read it again. What's happening is that we're engaging the world in conversations about human sexuality without a carefully constructed theology of the human body and human sexuality and gender. We find ourselves saying things that seem to come from nowhere in particular. Now, our culture has placed the conversation about human sexuality in a cultural narrative so that it thinks it's making great sense when it talks about human rights, civil rights, the whole idea of social justice, consenting adults, non-discrimination, marriage rights. There are framing words that are formed within the culture that we live in that bring a sense of cohesive rationality to what the world is saying about this. And as a person who has lived for the last 20-something years of my life on our Nazarene College campuses, I'm here to tell you the world is doing an outstanding job at discipling our youth in its narrative of human sexuality. And they're hitting our colleges with a very different understanding of it than what the church that formed those colleges does. So, these are the narratives that we live in. So, what do we do? Let's talk about some big rocks, might be the right thing to say, or some foundation posts for what we might say about human sexuality. We Wesleyans understand God as holy love. Now, by holy, I mean nothing else like it, one of a kind, in a reality all of itself, something that cannot be duplicated, replicated, copied, faked, holiness. The essence of God that only can be about our God, that can only come from our God. So we talk about holiness as that which is uniquely like our God in a way that nothing else can replicate it. Holy love is what we talk about. So by love, I mean self-emptying, open toward the other, making space for the other to exist, and willing to lay down life for the sake of the other. Holy love. This is the core of our understanding of the God that we worship. It's at the heart of the Wesleyan understanding of Trinity. This holy love is expressed in this relationship called Trinity. God in three persons, blessed Trinity, we sing. The union of the triune God is a mystery so profound that we are still hammering out Trinitarian theologies right now. I mean, you get into the world of theology. Tom Noble's book, Holy Trinity, Holy People, I think that is one of the best books I've read in years and years and years and years. Remarkable. The work that's being done around Trinity is essential to the conversation we're going to have about human sexuality. It's safe for Christians to say that the purest form of holy love is found in the relational exchange between Father, Son, and Spirit. And from this love, all of creation flows. I respect so deeply the work of N.T. Wright. He suggests that in the Genesis story, the created pairs are the core of our entire narrative. And he doesn't start with man-woman. He says, if you look at the Genesis account, you see this complementarity that happens. You've got heaven and earth, sun and moon, sea and dry land. And it all culminates in male and female. It's the complementarity of the creation itself that is the heart and soul. It's the kite of our narrative. Complementarity is. Now, this is what N.T. Wright says. It's all about God making complementary pairs which are meant to work together. The last scene in the Bible is the new heaven and the new earth, and the symbol for that is the marriage of Christ and His church. It's not just one or two verses here or there which say this or that. It's an entire narrative which works with this complementarity so that a male plus female marriage is a signpost or a signal about the goodness of the original creation and God's intention for the eventual new heavens and new earth. Of all that was created, there is only one unique creature into which God breathes His breath and declares that it is her, His own image and likeness. The dignity and character of God are embodied in the human creature. No other created being is given the relational and rational capacity to understand this or respond back to the Creator. The human is made from dust. Every Ash Wednesday, many of you probably practice the same as I did for those years, where the people line up and they come to the front of the church and you make the sign of the cross on their forehead and you say these words to them, "Remember that you are dust, and to dust you will return." Every time I did this, I experienced a sense of the sacred. I was announcing to my fellow human his or her essence. You are dependent dust. The human being is dependent dust. Walter Brueggemann writes this: we are fundamentally and elementally material in origin and composition, genuinely an earth creature, subject to all the realities and limitations of materiality. We share this quantity with all other creatures. But a handful of dust is by no means a human person. We scoops of dirt are not self-starters. The vitality of the human depends on God's gift of breath, which is freely and graciously given, but which never becomes the property or possession of the human person. I've been in birthing rooms and dying rooms across the years. Saw the birth of our three daughters. And I noted in those birthing rooms that that first breath for all three of those little girls was in. Once they got the lungs cleared of the fluid that was in the fetal sac, once that was cleared, there was this and all of a sudden there were colors and life, and a remarkable thing happened. First breath always in. And I've been in the dying rooms. I've never seen anybody take a breath and hold it and die. We expire. And there's always that last and you wait. When you think about dust-bound creatures, dependent dust creatures, who have given to them the very breath, the ruach of God, that sustains the inhale, the exhale, the inhale, the exhale, we are signs and signals in this world of what it means to be human. We're dependent beings, we're mobile aches, we're walking needs. And the psalmist is right in saying about us creatures, these all look to you to give them their food in due season. When you give to them, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they're filled with good things. When you hide your face, they're dismayed. When you take away their breath, they die and return their dust. When you send forth your breath, they are created. You renew the face of the ground. The fundamental essence of the human creature is that we are created as vulnerable, needy beings. And the union of a fragile creature with a faithful creator is the intent of our making. God fashioned us for relationship. We are made for relationship. I'm going to pause right here to make a point. The homosexually oriented young person at my university that desires to date a person of same-sex orientation, that person is expressing something profoundly godlike in that. They are saying, I need relationship. I need another human being. I cannot live by myself alone. And if we deny that expression of hunger for the other, we are denying something that is profoundly biblical about their very creation. We must enter into that conversation at a very different level than saying to them, you should not be desiring this other person. Because the reaching for the other is how we are made. Now, it may be a sign in terms of same-sex orientation that their reaching is a broken reaching. And it may be a disordered reaching, or it may be a wounded reaching. It's a reaching of some sort, but still it is a reaching that is human. It is deeply human, and we have to find our way to begin the conversation at that place. John Wesley was once asked, what is the most perfect of all creatures? And his answer was this: a void, capable of being filled with thee, by thee. The human being is this creature made capable of relationship with another and created with desire for the other. As Trinity is a relationship of love that is a mysterious union, even so the human is designed for union with God. The capacity for loving relationship is the image of God that is signed in us. But it doesn't end there. Our narrative also says that God created the human, male and female, He created them, and that it was good. But He also said it was not good that the male was alone. and no other material being filled the ache of this aloneness, not the birds or the trees or the rivers or the bees. Though he was made of the same dust stuff they were, they did not satisfy the longing created within him. Only when presented with the woman made of the same dust, yet fully other, did the male find his aloneness addressed in our story. God placed within the man and the woman sexual desire for the other. I find it interesting that our cultural narrative calls this basic animal instinct. It calls the human sexual desire for another basic animal instinct. I beg to differ. Man and woman made in the image of God with capacity for a union that signals the union of the Trinity itself. This is not descriptive of animals. This is the essence of human dignity. The narrative tells us that they are joined to one another and the two become one flesh. The Apostle Paul quotes this in Ephesians chapter 3. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a great mystery, and I am applying it to Christ and the church. You want to ask Paul, okay, which one are you talking about? His answer is both. I'm talking about both. It is unmistakable throughout Scripture that the sexual union of a man and a woman in marriage is a sign and witness to the essence of God. We see it in the Song of Solomon, the marriage of Hosea to Gomer, the language of the bride of Christ, and lots of other places. Our gender marks us as incomplete. The male or the female body makes no sense by itself. We're incapable of conceiving babies alone. Our bodies signal capacity for the other. Even our plumbing screams at the fact that we are not an end in ourselves. We are not created to be an end to ourselves. So what does our maleness and femaleness sign to the world about the God in whose image and likeness we're made? I think it says this. I think it says that love makes room for the other, that love freely empties itself for and into the other, that love has within it the capacity for new creations, new creatures, babies if you want, and that love is nurtured in a unity that is defenseless, naked and without shame, erotic and joyful. Our sexuality and the expression of it in marriage is meant to be a witness to the way that God is and the way that God loves. A theology of human sexuality has to begin in the character of God and bear witness to the holy love of God. Now, let's move to a little different level here. The doctrine of incarnation also speaks into this theology of human sexuality. The incarnation is God's signal to us that life as he intended it to be is meant to be experienced in a human body. Human bodies matter, really matter in our theology. Our senses, just think about, touch, taste, smell, sight, feel, hearing, all of this. Our senses are the antenna for the experiences of the world in which we live. If you take away all five of your senses, you cannot be aware of the world that is around you that you live in. God created us in this way. Senses are the antenna that allow us to experience the world in these bodies that God has created. Human flesh is sanctified, made holy by the life-giving breath of God. The bullseye, think about this, the bullseye of God's liberating and sanctifying grace is these sexual bodies of ours. To be even more direct, our sexual bodies are being built into the holy temple of God. Our sexuality is woven deep into our understanding of what it means to be the church. Think about the sensuality of what we do, of the sacraments that we have. We bathe people in baptism. We give them a bath. I mean, how much more sensual does something get? You know, the entrance into this body is a bath. The anointing with oil. I mean, that's what massage places do all over the place. They rub oil into people. Laying on of hands in ordination. You know, where else do you go that you go up to somebody and put your hands on their head? I mean, this is a moment in which we do something that is very sensual. Eating and drinking the body of our Lord to celebrate union with Christ. Infant dedications and baptisms, where we hold a child, we lift a child, we bless a child, we sprinkle water on a child. I mean, these are central practices that we have. Greeting one another with a holy kiss. Even our eschatology is rooted in the thought of a bride being readied for her lover. We wax eloquent on the wedding supper of the Lamb. Our theology is sexual to the core. Now, I am not suggesting that we sexualize God. God is holy other, holiness. But I am suggesting that coded within our bodies and our gender is a sign of the longing for God. God unites with His creatures in a loving relationship, and we're most holy when we ache to know this God, and when we long for intimacy with this God, and when we hunger to experience this God. That Hebrew word for sexual intimacy, yada, knowing, it's this same word. Our bodies are as theological as they are biological, and this is a material theology. Madonna was dead right about being a material girl in a material world. So what went wrong? In a word, sin fractured the trusting relationship between a faithful Creator and His fragile creatures. We seized the forbidden fruit because we desired to be something other than human. We wanted to rise above being dependent dust. We wanted to be independent. We did not want to be dependent dust. We wanted to not need anyone or anything for our completion, rather than being human as we were created to be. In our grasping, we believed that we could transcend our dustness, and rather than accepting our identity as the beloved creatures of God, we seized the opportunity to be equal with God. Rather than finding our ache met in God, we sought to erase the ache, and therefore we became subhuman. We fell. And we broke ourselves really bad when we did. And we have never fully recovered. In our lusting after self-sovereignty, we saw God as a thing that stood in our way rather than the very source of our life. If we could violate God's boundaries to get what we wanted, then it would be easy to do the same with our fellow humans. That's why I think God gave them clothes to protect them from one another. And lust was thus born. Christopher West, a wonderful Catholic writer, compares lust and love in this way. I think it may be one of the most prophetic lists that I've read. He says, lust is self-gratification where love is self-donation. Lust treats others as object where love treats others as subjects. Lust sees the body as something, love sees it as someone. Lust sacrifices others for oneself. Love sacrifices oneself for others. Lust grasps at fleeting pleasure. Love yearns for eternal joy. Lust enslaves us. Love liberates us. Lust jealously possesses where love confidently trusts. Lust manipulates and controls while love respects the other's freedom. Lust is aimed at any pleasing outlet. Love is reserved for only one. Lust ends when the pleasure ends. Love lasts through good and bad. Lust makes us feel used. Love makes us feel treasured. Lust is this twisted desire. It is the image of God ache for the other bent inward in a harmful way, which is at the core of our definition of sin. Love perverted. Love turned inward. Christopher West also says we've made two attempts as a church dealing with our bent sexual desire. One of them is the starvation diet. The starvation diet says your desires are bad, they'll get you in trouble, learn to repress them. The other way we've dealt with it is the culture's way, which is the fast food diet. Indulge your desires as often and as cheaply as you possibly can. But when the human body is reduced to a biological unit with erotic desires, when we champion our personal rights to pursue the fulfillment of those desires, we've lost our dignity as human beings. Our sexual desires are at the core of our humanity, and they signal something to us about God. Advertisers, marketers, actually know this a whole lot better than Christians do. James Smith writes in his book, Desiring the Kingdom. Let's see, here we go. He writes, he says, I think we should first recognize and admit that the marketing industry, which promises an erotically charged transcendence through media that connect our heart to our imagination, that it's operating with a better, more creational, more incarnational, more holistic anthropology than much of the Christian world. In other words, I think we must admit that the marketing industry is able to capture, form, and direct our desires precisely because they have rightly discerned that we are embodied, desiring creatures whose hearts are governed by imagination. Marketers have figured out the way to our heart because they get it. They rightly understand that at root we are erotic creatures, creatures that are oriented primarily by love and passion and desire. In sum, he writes, I think Victoria is in on a secret. It's why this kind of marketing world sells things. It has rightly discerned the human being and the human body as a desiring, sensual creation of God in these ways. So where do we go from here? The meaning of human persons is at stake in our culture. Is it even possible after the fall to be set free from lust? Can we ever once again see the body as a revelation of our created dignity and a sign of the God who made us? I don't know if our cultural narrative of sexual desire can be reclaimed or reformed or redeemed. We may be too far gone. But then we are the followers of a dead man, crucified and buried, 3 days in the tomb, far past recovery, and God raised him to life. If God can resurrect dead flesh, might this same God also sanctify living flesh? We say that God raised us Nazarenes up to declare the doctrine of heart holiness. So let's. Let's declare that lust is forgivable, porn is forgivable, sleeping around and infidelity and prostitution, they're all forgivable, but they're all repeatable until the twisted desire that drives them is reformed, or better yet, transformed. Do not be conformed to the pattern of this world, this dying culture, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds. Our gospel of sanctification is about resurrection to new life, about cleansing of the heart's desires, about purity, about love made whole, about liberation from bondage, about maturity and likeness to Christ. We need to declare a doctrine of holiness at the core of our understanding of human sexuality if we're going to have any uniting narrative to address the world in which we live. The other thing I think I might say is this. We may be losing ground in the battle of sexual narratives because our people are not experiencing the kind of sanctification that transforms their sexual desires and forms love where lust once ruled. This requires a crisis death to the old, but a long maturation into the new. Now, let me get to some topics that I'm guessing were on your heart and mind to come to a seminar like this. And I'll address maybe five quick ones. Singleness. We've really done a lousy job at imagining for our single adults how they might live a rich and vibrant life in the context of the culture where they are now. Single adults are not sexless persons. They are fully sexual human beings who long for the kind of intimacy and belonging that will sustain them. To be single is neither a call to sexual repression nor a signal of failure. It is the way of life for those who are not married. Singleness, the way of life for those who are not married. And singles are fully aware of the ache for the other that they live into. They live into that ache as those who refuse to use another person to quench the ache. They respect the boundary of clothes. They recognize the dignity of the other person. They seek intimate friendships that sustain their celibate life. So, you know, no more demeaning of single adulthood. No more Sunday school classes named Pairs and Spares. We've got to do a better job with singleness that's out there. It's a piece that I have to leave out tonight in the address that I'm going to give, but a key piece that I'm seeing in 1 Peter. He talks a lot about the oikos and the household of God as the identity-forming reality for people in exile. Like it or not, we can defend the nuclear family all we want, but human beings are living together in all kind of arrangements that are not like the nuclear family, the mom and dad and 2.5 kids. Human beings are beginning, out of their ache for the other, which is a part of their humanity, they're beginning to just move in under roofs in all kind of arrangements. It reminds me a lot of what the world that the gospel went into was like, the household, the oikos. It was both slave and free. It was extended families. It was visitors who came from other places. It was people that had been taken in. The household was a very different thing than our mom, dad, and a couple of kids. And I think we're going to have to find our way back there in dealing with single adulthood again. I'm saying the church in exile, if it's going to be effective, it's going to have to figure out how to imagine living arrangements that will support the celibacy that we call single adults too, in a rich context of oikos belonging. Now, I wish I had some time to work on that. I'll be working on that at the theology conference later this fall at NTS. But we have to help a single adult imagine a thriving life. And I think the church can do that, and I think we have biblical story and theology for it. Got to keep going here. Second thing, let me address really quick, premarital sex, casual sex, recreational sex. We have to make the case for chastity that is life-affirming. We're not doing that in a very good way. A story is better than anything. When I was a college student at Trevecca, I worked at the Alamo Plaza Hotel 4 nights a week. I went into work at 10:30 at night and got off at 7:30 in the morning. That was we didn't have any money. It was the only way I was going to be able to go to college. So I went and I worked that night shift. I would check all the guests in, and then I could do some homework and stuff through the night, and then close up the books in the morning and learn to be an accountant on that particular job, which has helped me with numbers in a lot of ways. The guy right ahead of me was named Jerry. He was a law student from over at Vanderbilt. And Jerry ran the afternoon shift, 3:30 to 10:30. And Jerry would often say to me as I was coming in, when you do the night transcript, if you have any problems or anything, just give me a buzz. I'll be back in room. And he would give me the name of a room. He had hit on all the guests until he found a single girl or any woman that would invite him back to her room when he got off shift. And so Jerry did this hundreds of times. And quite often, middle of the night, he would come back into the office again. Hey, having any trouble with the books or anything? He said, yeah, I said, I got another trophy for my trophy room. And he had a pair of women's underwear, and he would take them, and he would open the, we all had lockers back in the office, and he would hang another one up there as one other conquest. I remember the night, I mean, I worked there for like 2 years, and I remember the night Jerry came in, middle of the night, sat on the couch and just slumped. And he just looked as depressed as he could be. I said, what's up? He said, I don't get it. And I said, what don't you get? He said, here you are. You go to this Christian school over here. You're dating this really hot girl, and you hadn't even slept with her yet. And he said, you know, I can have all the women that I want all the time. And he said, I am so lonely. And he said, your friends from the college come down here all the time. Swimming pool out here, and they call you in the night, so they'll drop you a hamburger by. He says, I have nobody in my life who would do that. I have no one in my life. And I remembered saying to him, Jerry, you may not get it, but I do. The pattern and practice of your life is bond and break, bond and break, use and walk away, possess and leave. The very practice of your life makes you a human being that will forever be lonely because you have not learned how to bond yourself to another person in a way that there is a relationship that is energizing and life-giving and thriving. You know, as a young Trevecca student, I think it was the Spirit of God saying something very profound to me about human sexuality. And what I like to say to college students quite often is the sexual act is something in which a part of one person is given to another person in an indelible way that can never be forgotten or erased again. And it is God's intent that by the discipline and protection and stewardship of this remarkable gift of bonding, that human beings are able to reach the pinnacle of their creation in the image and likeness of God. And God is not trying to deny us of some erotic pleasure. God is trying to teach us how to be bond to another person, that we fully come to be human in the highest imaginable way that there is. To bond and break, disrobe and re-robe, love and leave, is destructive of persons. This assumes that sex is only physical and that it has no spiritual dimension. This offends our created dignity, and this habitual practice cripples our capacity to love, to bind and stay bound, to commit. A word about marital sex. This is what I said least about, that I think maybe needs to have most said about it. I'm working on a whole new chapter on this one. Marriage does not legalize lust for Christians in their relationship. We are still called to love our spouse sexually in a way that causes them to feel treasured and dignified rather than used. Can I say that sentence again? We are still called to love our spouse sexually in a way that causes them to feel treasured and dignified rather than used. The number of times in pastoral counseling I've had a Christian wife most of the time say to me, "I'm so tired of being a character in his sexual fantasy. I don't feel loved. I feel used." If the church is once again to have a vibrant message that is winsome in our culture, the marriages in our churches are going to have to be comprised of that kind of love. That kind of love that is gracious and affirming and dignifying. Then we will have something that the human being is created to long for and want. One of the great joys that Denise and I have had across 43 years is that most of our pastoral ministry has been on a college campus, and now for the last 12 years as president on one of our campuses. And to have young couples that just come to us and they say, we want what you have. We want to love one another the way we see you love one another. How do you get that? For our church to be filled with that kind of sainthood is critically important for the witness that we're to bear in a world which is being used and discarded at such a rapid rate by the sexual practices that are there. Even some of our students, I have a dear friend on our campus, a male who is homosexually oriented, and who really went off the deep end, some horrible practices and behaviors for a period of time. Today he is celibate and is living a wonderful life of faithfulness to God. He said, "Do not believe for a moment that what's happening in male homosexuality, by and large, everywhere that I went and experienced, has any love in it at all." He said, "There is a fracturing of the human soul and body that is happening at such levels that," he said, "I came away from one of those finally one night and my eyes were open." And he said, "I knew that if I continued down this road, I would probably be dead within a year." He said, "The violence, the pain, the non-committalness in that." And he said, "But at the same time, I'm telling you, all of my friends who are practicing in this way, are what they're hungry for is to be loved, to truly be loved." He said, "Don't throw rocks. Don't make this a double-filled community." He said, "These are people that are so deeply broken, but their practices are not bringing them to the kind of fulfillment that they're longing for." A word about pornography. Quick word here. I'm watching our time. Pornography is the art of objectification. We consume another person in the mental studio of our mind as if they were a purchased product. We use the image of that person for our selfish gratification. It is subhuman, animalistic, and destructive of persons and families. But the desire that a person is trying to address in going to pornography is at the core of their true humanity, their longing for the other. But their desire has been twisted and it needs a redeeming and a maturing. I've had yet to find a single student or person in pastoral ministry who overcame pornography by sheer willpower. They had to be reformed in their desiring, and it took the help of other believers to do that. Homosexuality. Let's talk about that one for a minute. The process is underway in our culture to normalize same-sex attraction. It's now been removed from the American Psychological Association list of disorders. It's no longer declared to be a disorder. It has gone mainstream now with winsome gay characters on just about every TV sitcom there is. Same-sex marriage is now the law of the land, and attorneys are going to make millions in the coming years fighting us about religious rights versus same-sex rights and all these things. My pastoral experience has acquainted me with many homosexually oriented persons, and I've loved every one of them. They become like family, some of them, very much like family, a person that we took into our home for a period of years, and it's like a daughter to us today. Now I want to divide homosexuality into two different groups, if you'll allow me here for a minute. In one of these groups, I've heard stories of rape, abuse, molestation, power, lust, trauma, horrible families, irresponsible adults, and loss of innocence. These experiences have disordered the sexual identity of persons for whom Christ died, and I am broken inside over the depth of their pain. They have mental images, mental tapes running in their minds that inform their behavior. And I strongly believe they need godly counsel and help if they're ever to reclaim the dignity of their own bodies. They also need guidance in their relationships. They need justice for what was done to them and mercy toward those who did it. They need to experience the power to forgive and the power to be forgiven. To declare that their disoriented sexual identity is normal, or that God made them this way, is to rob them of hope and help. Same-sex attraction for these persons is not a sign of normality, but a sign of a broken world. And lest you hear me pointing fingers, declaring all same-sex oriented persons to be broken, I too take my place in the line of those broken in some way by the pervasiveness of sin in this world. My sexuality needed redeeming too. My sexuality was broken. Apart from Jesus Christ in my life and the conversion experience that I have, I probably would have been a user of human beings right through college like every other lost person may have well been. My sexuality was broken too. It needed redeeming. It was affected by the darkness of sin. So for us to say that this is a sign of brokenness of the world instead of this is how God made us is not suddenly to take ourselves out of the category of broken and say, you're broken, we're not, I'm heterosexual, you're homosexual, I'm the way God intended for me to be, you're not. We both have to have redemption from God at the very core of the way that we desire within our life. To normalize brokenness is to doom us to saving ourselves. And as believers in the holy love of God, we are not loving people if we do this. Now, let me talk about another side, okay? I've also pastored people who grew up in the most normal and exemplary of homes and are homosexually oriented. The ache they feel for another is central to their humanity and should not be dismissed as something that they ought to just get over. But whatever this same sex is, I believe it is not a signal of the way that God made us, and it is not a sign of the mystery of God, but rather it is another sign of the brokenness of our world. So instead of pronouncing homosexual unions as biblical marriage, we have to ask, how do we best help these persons deal with desires that are broken, but that are yet the legitimate cry of the human heart for another? How do we get in that conversation? To place a moral stigma on a person's orientation alone is wrong. But to declare that a homosexual orientation is the created intent of God is just as wrong. Our call to a vibrant life of celibacy will not be accepted by everyone, in much the same way that our call to tithing is not accepted by everyone. So we'll need to figure out what love looks like when its wisdom is rejected. Boy, I'm going to skip a couple of pieces here. I think one of the questions we're going to have to answer is, now that the cultural narrative has flipped and we're on the discriminating side of that narrative at this particular point, the people that we've made jokes about in our pulpit, the people that we've talked about as if they were not there, the people that we have not taken the pain to hear their story, this part of the world, now that power has shifted, they're quite angry. And we seem to be the low-hanging fruit for the anger of a transgendered, homosexual world that we live in these days. The question is, are we going to be able to accept their anger and respond in love? Are we going to be able to bless when we are persecuted? Are we going to be able to be in those relationships without becoming defensive and attacking back again? Are we ready to stand with the generation that sees human sexuality different than what we do? I think I need to add just a personal note here. This is just a word of wisdom for pastors. Your congregations need to be having conversations about, your congregations need to have conversations about human sexuality. I would encourage you, unless you're very secure in the pastorate that you're in, not to make yourself the center of that discussion. It's what I've learned from a lot of pastors who use my book, Charitable Discourse, in their congregation. It's much better to slide a book in the middle of the table and say, hey, can we have conversations about this? And then it's not you bringing up everything so that everybody out there is trying to decide whether they agree with you or disagree with you. And then you're able to stand back, like a lot of pastors do with my book on charitable discourse, and say, I don't agree with him at all. I don't know where this guy's coming from. And, you know, I'm hundreds of miles away, and that's fine. But what happens is, if you can create a venue of a conversation in which you're not the person at the pinnacle of that, you're not doing all the presenting, you're going to be at a much better place to guide the conversation, lead the conversation. That's just a little piece of wisdom. Let me close. I've come to see a text in a different way than I have before. You remember when, at the death of Jesus, the veil of the temple is rent, is just ripped open? For years I preached that the people of God had tried to box the Holy Spirit in, and now at the death of Jesus it's ripped and the Spirit can get out into the world and, you know, do everything that needs to be done. And that may well be the right theological reading of that, but I've seen something different here in recent days. We protect and boundary that which is most sacred. Just as God said in the creation account itself, the tree in the center of the garden is mine. You respect me when you respect it. And that this holy of holies, this place where the presence of God was meant to dwell, it is ripped open in the death of Jesus. In other words, the Christ that we made naked on the cross, the Christ that we exposed the very essence of holiness, the Holy of Holies. The curtain is now ripped into. We disrobed it, dismantled it, ripped it open. But what the world saw in that act was nothing more than pure love. And what the world needs to see from us is this kind of purity of love that flows in this way. We veil that which is holy to respect its dignity and to protect it from usage that cheapens it. The human body needs to be viewed again as that which is sacred in the sight of God, that which has been profoundly made in likeness to God, that which is clothed for a reason, that which is not shared with the whole world, that which is not exposed, that which is somehow protected and stewarded right. Relationships of dignity call for respect. And to enter behind the veil into the Holy of Holies without due devotion and commitment is deadly. To unveil a human body in an act of pornography, rape, casual sex, lust, whatever it is, we dehumanize ourselves in this act. and become so much less than what we were intended to be. But Jesus invites us to enter the Holy of Holies by a new and living way, opened up for us through the veil, so that we might have our hearts sprinkled clean by that love in that place and desire as God intended. My mom died a few years ago from Alzheimer's, and I watched my dad care for her across the last 3 years that she was there in a nursing home just down the street. For 3 years, he fed her 3 meals a day, sat by her bedside, had devotions with her every night. I have no clue whether she knew he was there or not, whether she recognized him. But I watched that act of loving devotion happen day after day after day. We could not get him to even leave town. He should have. He should have taken a break. He should have loved himself, cared for himself a little more. He was there all that time. The year that she died, that next year in Dad's life, there was a profound loneliness in him. And so we three kids, I mean, we took our turns. Every third day I would call, and then my sisters would call the other 2 days. And I saw my dad, and I heard my dad just expressing. And you know what he started talking about so much? His longing to be with her again in heaven. That longing that was there. My daughter Ashley sang at Mom's funeral, and the words she sang have still stayed with me. And they kind of talk about Dad. Soon and very soon I'll be going to the place he has prepared for me. There my sin erased, shame forgotten. Soon and very soon I will be with the one I love. With unveiled face I'll see him. There my soul will be satisfied. Soon and very soon. Though I have not seen him, my heart knows his name. Jesus Christ, the Lamb, the Lord of heaven. I will be with the one I love. With unveiled face I'll see him. There my soul will be satisfied, soon and very soon. That longing that the believer has to be in the presence of Jesus fully and completely is the kind of longing that we are made capable of with another human being in a covenanted relationship. And for us to declare that and bear witness to that in the world that we're living in is critical for what it means for us to be the people of God and the church of God.